From NPR News in New York, this is the Bryant Park Project with Allison Stewart and Luke Burbank.
Hello there. This is the Bryant Park Project, your home for news and information and bad rapping by white people. We're going to have more on that coming up in just a little bit. I'm Luke Burbank. To my left is Allison Stewart.
I so look forward to that. I'm so glad I made it here. I went to IKEA on a Sunday. Somebody slap me if I ever decide to do that again, Luke.
Yeah, there's a bus that goes from the Port Authority in New York to IKEA, which is somehow, I think, the most depressing thing ever is to board a crappy bus at the Port Authority to go to a place where they sell kind of crappy furniture.
There was almost a riot in the ball pit. I almost lost Matt Martinez somewhere in housewares. But we're back, and we're ready to start the show. Karl Rove has announced that he's going to resign at the end of August. We'll have a look at Rove's past, present, and future.
We're also going to debut a new segment called While You Were Out, Possibly Drinking. We're also going to talk about people stranded in the tarmac at LAX because of some computer problems, a dirty bomb threat in New York City, and much, much more.
Yeah, it was one of those big kind of weird news weekends. We're also going to check out something new called The Most. Okay, it's not that new to me. It's the name of the show I used to host, and I trademarked the name so MSNBC can't sue us. Look at the most popular, the high and the low of it all, from People Magazine to the New York Times.
I have some trademarks on this show. I've trademarked the Bryant Park Project. Luke Burbank is awesome.net. Also, we're going to talk about an internet story that's buzzing around. Pearl Jam went off on President Bush in song form, and then it was kind of censored, and they're getting all upset. Right now, though, it's time for today's top story.
Karl Rove is moving on down the road.
Yep, President Bush's deputy chief of staff and decades-long political advisor Karl Rove will resign at the end of this month. Mr. Rove, who helped shape both Mr. Bush's gubernatorial race in Texas as well as his White House runs, earned the nicknames The Architect, Boy Genius, Bush's Brain, Turd Blossom. Mr. Bush came up with that last one himself because many people think that Rove's, that last nickname, or at least half of it is true, or that he's a political mastermind of great proportions, or both of them. This news is indeed the big story of the day. Here's Karl Rove making the official announcement at the White House this morning.
Today I submitted my resignation as Deputy Chief of Staff and Senior Advisor effective the end of the month. Mr. President, I'm grateful for the opportunity you gave me to serve our nation and you.
He basically put in 2-week notice, and the Thursday and Friday of his last week, he's going to train his replacement and probably call in sick on the last half. Actually, the president did accept his resignation, and here's what Mr. Bush had to say.
We've known each other as youngsters interested in serving our state. And we worked together so we could be in a position to serve this country. And so I thank my friend. I'll be on the road behind you here in a little bit.
Got to clear some brush down in Crawford. You know, these guys have been buddies for evs.
Yeah, I mean,
Texas days.
The Karl Rove George Bush connection goes so far back that a lot of people wonder if Karl Rove isn't the one making all the policy. That's been a big discussion point.
Yeah, it kind of has a little. It always had a little bit of a Cyrano de Bergerac kind of quality.
Like Svengali, if you want to go that far.
Kind of pasty dudes. Smart, pasty guy hiding in the weeds and the kind of more telegenic, better pedigreed guy being the decider. And Karl Rove, by the way, he was a pretty smart guy, obviously, but he was also a very, very sort of a true believer in his heart. And he always has sort of seen good things for the Republicans, a lot of which have sort of come true. Some of his predictions have not been as prescient. This was Karl Rove on NPR's All Things Considered with Robert Siegel last October, right before the midterm elections.
Many would consider you on the optimistic end of realism about
not that you would be exhibiting a bias or that. You're just making a comment.
I'm looking at all the same polls that you're looking at.
No, you're not.
Every day.
No, you're not.
Oh, I'm not.
No, you're not. You're not. I'm looking at 68 polls a week. You may be looking at 4 or 5 public polls a week.
So you're looking
I'm looking at all of these, Robert, and adding them up, and I add up to a Republican Senate and a Republican House. Okay. You may end up with a different math, but you're entitled to your math. I'm entitled to the math.
And as you know, the Republicans retain the majority in the House and the – wait,
I just haven't seen him get that testy since Sheryl Crow went up to him and asked him something at a big White House dinner. My goodness.
Yeah.
I never heard that before.
Yeah. We're going to talk more about this coming up. But, yeah, it's interesting timing, and there's a lot to sort of talk about with old Turd Blossom.
All right. David Green, NPR's White House correspondent, is going to roll on by and talk to us about Karl Rove in just a moment. But first, here's Matt Martinez with the news.
Thanks, guys. Hello, everyone. Here are some of the stories from NPR News and some of the stories that we're following. The chief U.S. nuclear envoy said that he and his North Korean counterpart have reached a limited agreement on the next steps toward nuclear disarmament. Christopher Hill said the two sides have an agreement that they are going to try to identify types of disablement and how they can approach it, but he said they have not reached any kind of agreement on the dismantling of North Korea's nuclear facilities. They sent another video camera deep inside a Utah coal mine where six miners are trapped, but still there were no signs of life. This latest attempt at sending down the camera was paired with better lighting. Al Davis is the man who oversees Western operations for the Federal Mine Safety and Health Administration. He said the images came back included a distorted conveyor belt and an intact roof only. NASA is trying to decide whether to send astronauts on a spacewalk to repair a small gash on the belly of the space shuttle Endeavour. A chunk of insulating foam from the shuttle's fuel tank apparently hit the orbiter at liftoff last week, creating a 3.5-inch-long gouge that penetrates all the way through the thermal shielding on the shuttle's underside. A team of astronauts spent yesterday working with a robotic arm to get scanning equipment up close to the damaged tiles. They sent photos and 3D images back to Earth for analysis. Two women were freed by the Taliban today. They were among the 23 South Koreans kidnapped by the group in mid-July. Two male captives were executed by gunfire in late July. 14 women and 5 men are still being held. The Taliban have been demanding the release of 21 militant prisoners being held in jails by the Afghan government and the United States military at the base in Bagram. The man who headed the Chinese company behind the recall of millions of toys earlier this month committed suicide over the weekend. Zhang Shuhong was the owner of the Li Der Industrial Company, which made toys for Mattel for 15 years. He hanged himself in a company warehouse in Foshan in southern China. Tiger Woods picked up the 13th major title of his career at the PGA Championship, finishing 2 strokes better than runner-up Woody Austin at Southern Hills. It was the hottest major ever played, with triple-digit temperatures all 4 days in Tulsa. We have a complete sports roundup with Bill Wolf coming up later in the program. At the box office this weekend, Underdog debuted at number five, the new sci-fi flick with Claire Danes, Stardust, at number four. Number three, The Simpsons Movie and The Bourne Ultimatum was knocked down to second place by Rush Hour 3, that was number one, with $50.2 million. Repeating our top story, Karl Rove, President Bush's close friend and chief political strategist, announced today that he will leave the White House at the end of August, joining a growing line of senior officials heading for the exits in the final 1.5 years of the administration. I'm Matt Martinez. Those are the latest headlines from NPR News. The news is always online at npr.org. Back to you, Luke and Allison.
Thank you, Matt. You're
Things
welcome. You may not have known about Karl Rove. He was born on Christmas Day. During his first year in college, he learned the man he thought was his father was not. Did you know that? And you know, he wants to spend more time with his family. Mm-hmm. At least that's what he told the Wall Street Journal when he gave them an interview. We'll call it his exit interview, telling them he was going to resign at the end of this month. David Green is NPR's White House correspondent, and you've been up since very early this morning covering this story, David. So thanks for taking 5 minutes to be with us.
No problem. I was out here covering the presidential race in Iowa. I didn't expect to be awakened to talk about Karl Rove. It's been very exciting.
So it was a complete surprise then?
It was a surprise. It was a big surprise. I wanted to ask you both first, though. Turd Blossom, do you know where that comes from, the president's
sure.
nickname?
Go.
It's a little, it's like cow poop and then a flower grows up through
yes.
it, right?
Exactly. I had to look that up. So it says a lot about how the president views Karl Rove. This was a total surprise. But I'll tell you, Rove has been sort of invisible in the White House the last few months. So if we're going to do a little Monday morning quarterbacking, it might make sense because usually the reporters around the White House will run into him. He might be strolling around outside the West Wing. He sometimes gives reporters a hard time, tries to distribute chocolate to them, which, you know, of course, is unethical as unbiased journalists to accept any sort of sweets from a senior member of the White
dirty.
House. But it's been hard to find him recently, so it seems to make sense. And as we learned from him and from President Bush today, they've been talking about this for a year or longer.
That's what he said. Let's hear it in his own words.
It's not been an easy decision, as you know from our discussions that started last summer. It always seemed there was a better time to leave somewhere out there in the future. But now is the time.
He also told the Journal, I'm not going to stay or go based on whether it pleased the mob. And we're not talking about Tony Soprano's mob, I guess. Fill people in on what Karl Rove's talking about, David.
Well, it was funny. You guys brought up that he said he's leaving to hang out more with his family, which is what everyone says when they're leaving the White House or a top post in government. He said in that Wall Street Journal, as you said, that he's not – he didn't make his decision to please the mob. And there's been quite a mob after him for years. I mean, he's been accused by Democrats for a long, long time of dirty political trickery and being very, very shrewd. And he's always, brushed aside those criticisms. And it looked like he was ready to be indicted by Patrick Fitzgerald, a special prosecutor who was looking into the leak of CIA operative Valerie Plame's identity. And he somehow escaped that. He's been subpoenaed by Democrats on Capitol Hill recently, who think that he basically was behind all the U.S. attorney firings. So I think he wanted to make a point of saying, this is not about all of that. This is not running away from my critics. I'm leaving on my own terms.
Now, he has a reputation as being a political brawler. Is there any one time in his tenure at the White House or even during his just association with Mr. Bush that this was really evident?
It's funny. He hides it pretty well, and he takes on this kind of jokester persona when reporters are around. I think he likes to play that shtick as if, no one can touch me. The news might be bad, the criticism, but, I'm my own guy. But there was one time. It was the day before the 2006 election, and I was traveling with the president down in Florida, and he was having a big rally in Pensacola. And at the last minute, the gubernatorial candidate, the Republican, Charlie Crist, decided to cancel appearing with Bush, with Mr. Bush. He decided to go to Palm Beach instead. And it was amazing. Rove came out and didn't even realize the cameras were rolling, didn't even realize NPR had a microphone nearby. And he said, let's see how many people show up in Palm Beach on 24 hours notice versus 8,000 or 9,000 who are going to be in Pensacola with the president. So very rare you would hear Karl Rove trash a Republican. But that's what happens when you're as loyal as Karl Rove was to the president, when you've got a gubernatorial candidate from the Republican Party dissing him.
There's only 525 days left in Mr. Bush's presidency. So in reality, though, does he still need Mr. Rove in any capacity, or is this more about the Republicans Party?
It's hard to say. I think the biggest difference in the White House and for President Bush is going to be that personal relationship. I mean, if you look back, Karl Rove, they've known each other for 30 or so years, 34, I think. President Bush had him, had Karen Hughes, had Dan Bartlett, had this real tight inner circle of advisors around him every day when he came in. They've been leaving one by one. Now the three of them are gone. And, the White House former presidents say as lonely as it is, especially in the last year or two. And now he's going to be without his closest people. Now, as for the party, Rove says he's not going to sign on to any other campaigns. And given the president's approval ratings right now, I don't know if any presidential candidates in the Republican Party would want him.
Huh. Good point. David Green, NPR's White House correspondent. Thanks for walking us through it, David.
Sure thing.
Hey,
have a good one, you
David,
guys.
David, I appreciate the favor, but I just need to tell you, November 7th, Seahawks, Steelers.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Ooh. We're on that.
Yeah.
And you're going down.
If they win again, you're dead to me. There are, as David was talking about, there are all these political kind of reasons for Karl Rove's departure and maybe the timing as to why he's leaving right now. But of course, as we have mentioned a couple times already, they used the tried and true reason when they were talking about why he's leaving. Here's how the president described it.
Talking to Karl for a while about his desire to spend more time with Darby and Andrew. This is a family that's made enormous sacrifices, not only for our beloved state of Texas, but for a country we both love.
Yes, that's right. The classic. He wants to, for some reason, someone was shooting off bottle rockets behind the president when he said that. Yeah, he wants to spend more time with his family.
That's like the dog ate my homework.
Yes.
Of political exits, the creative differences of rock bands breaking up.
Exactly, because how can you really get down on someone for wanting to spend more time with their family? Even though, I kind of oddly, Karl Rove's son is in college now. So his kid doesn't even live at home. His wife presumably lives in D.C. with him. I don't know, you know, why he would be able to do more family time, I guess. But we thought this would be a good time to go through some of the greatest moments in spending more time with your family.
It must have been cold there in my shadow.
February 2000, right after the St. Louis Rams win the Super Bowl, Coach Dick Vermeil breaks down crying as he announces he's retiring to spend time with his wife and 11 grandkids. He calls it the perfect ending to his coaching career, which resumes 1 year later when he signs a 3-year deal to coach the Kansas City Chiefs. November 2006, Tennessee Republican Senator Bill Frist pulls out of the 2008 presidential race to spend more time with his family. He says, in the Bible, God tells us, for everything there's a season, and for me, for now, the season of being an elected official has come to an end. By pure coincidence, the news comes after several polls show Frist trailing pretty much every candidate for president on the Republican side in 2008. April 2002, Karen Hughes, a close advisor to the president, announces she's leaving the White House to spend more time with her teenage son. Of course, when she actually spends time with her teenage son, she promptly signed back on to be the administrator, or the undersecretary, rather, of state for public diplomacy and public affairs. And finally, in 1998, Jack Schaefer wrote in Slate magazine about a guy named Richard Hazeltine, my personal hero. He was the chairman of the Overseas Investment Trust. He resigned after fighting with his bosses. This was his leaving statement. Quote, let me put it this way. It's nothing to do with ill health. It's not to pursue other interests. It's not to spend more time with my family.
At least the man was in. It was honest.
Yeah. That's a guy who should run for president. And that is great moments in spending more time with your family.
Coming up on the Bryant Park Project, some news stories that hit the front pages while you were out.
Possibly drinking.
Or sleeping in.
Also, we'll have some of the most emailed and passed around stories from a variety of different news outlets.
The high, the low of it all. And we say goodbye to a pioneer, Tony Wilson. The founder of Factory Records passed away over the weekend. We'll talk about his influences with Rob Sheffield from Rolling Stone.
This is the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. Welcome back to the Bryant Park Project over the soulful sounds of the band Aqueduct, if you're curious about some of the music that we listen to on this show. By the way, I'm Luke Burbank.
And I'm Allison Stewart. Coming up very shortly, we're going to see what a lot of people are interested in. We're going to take a stroll through some of the most emailed, the most searched, the most blog lists from a most wide-ranging group of online sources, shall we say.
First, though, we're going to catch up on some of the stories that made headlines this weekend, stories that you might have missed doing, you know, things that people do on the weekend, decorating your home, gardening, spending time with friends. possibly drinking. So, you know, you come in on Monday morning, and it's like you don't exactly know what happened. Well, this is the kind of show where we might fill you in on those things. So.
Yeah, to help catch us up on the weekend's news is the Bryant Park Project's pinch hitter, the beautiful and knowledgeable Matt Martinez.
It's a great intro. It's a great intro. Who wrote that?
Hi, my mic's on. This is on-air piloting at its best. I wrote that intro, actually. That was me. Okay, so here's what you may have missed if you weren't glued to the news this weekend. The creator of Jeopardy and Wheel of Fortune, Merv Griffin, he died of prostate cancer. He was 82 years old. Griffin was also the host of his own TV show for more than 20 years. And here's Merv explaining why the game shows he created were so successful.
I think the utter simplicity of Wheel and Jeopardy, you could explain the entire game and how it was played in 5 seconds. You know, we give the answers, you give the questions, and go. It's the simplicity, and then plus the audience involvement at home. And I've found it to be true, too. When I'm watching, I'll yell out an answer, and everybody in the room says, gee, we didn't know you knew that. We thought you were stupid.
And you know, Merv never stopped working. When he entered a hospital a month ago, he was working on the first week of production of a new syndicated game show called Merv Griffin Crosswords. The man was a juggernaut.
Rest
Absolutely.
In peace, Merv.
Yes.
You know, now the game shows, by the way, are so complicated. Like, what's the one where you pick the suitcases, the gold suitcases? Deal or No Deal? It's like an 11th grade probability.
The title's Deal or No Deal. That's Deal, No Deal. I'm not really sure what's difficult.
There's this whole you're eliminating numbers that you don't want to have, and I don't know. It can
deal.
Be
Well, here's
no
some
deal.
Other news from the weekend. A reported threat on a website of a dirty bomb attack, of a potential dirty bomb attack in New York City led to heightened security this weekend. And if you were on a bridge going to IKEA, it affected you.
Yes.
The threat was reported on a Jerusalem-based website called Depgafile. It says it has more than 1 million daily readers. Intelligence experts say the site is super unreliable. But still, the New York Police Department increased its radiological monitoring and established checkpoints to examine vehicles at various locations around Manhattan.
And truthfully, I had dirty martinis Friday night when this came over our Blackberries.
Suggestive. It's very suggestive.
I did.
You hear a dirty bomb, you want a dirty martini. Former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney
won the Iowa
straw poll. I
want one even when I don't hear dirty bomb. That's just me.
And we should note, while Mitt Romney won the Iowa straw poll, former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani was considered the front runner, and Senator John McCain of Arizona decided to skip the event. But Romney says that doesn't diminish his win. He says the fact that Giuliani and McCain decided not to compete demonstrated his campaign strength. Former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee came in second. Former Wisconsin Governor Tommy Thompson placed sixth and then promptly dropped out of the race. And, you know, Thompson made the Iowa straw poll the focal point of his campaign, visiting all 99 counties. But he never got any momentum. Fortunately for the fans of his last name, Thompson, former Tennessee Senator Fred Thompson is expected to formally enter the race next month. And in Los Angeles, a U.S. Customs computer crashed Saturday afternoon and stayed down for nearly 10 hours. It prevented authorities from screening passengers. More than 17,000 travelers were affected by the computer failure, and lots of people were kept on planes overnight. Airport employees had to refuel planes to keep their power units and AC running. Maintenance trucks serviced the ground aircraft lavatories. And aren't you guys glad you spent the weekend drinking?
I'm always glad. I got to stop, by the way, with a constant string of jokes about me drinking too much because people are going to think I'm serious
at
some
point. It's unprofessional.
The white dudes want to see us fail.
What white dudes?
Jack Donaghy, General Electric, George Bush, Karl Rove.
Karl Rove, you say?
That's Tracy Morgan and Tina Fey on the show 30 Rock talking about Karl Rove. Rove. The thing is, actually, though, beyond just that, which is very funny, for people politically on the left, Karl Rove has been just like the total like Darth Vader.
Target on his back.
Yeah.
Kept them going, sort of the wind beneath their wings in a weird way.
Yeah, yeah. Like he was totally kind of the Antichrist, you know. And I've actually been to, you know, like I was at this liberal blogging conference called the Yearly Coast last year when it was in Las Vegas. And just to see the amount of vitriol that people were directing at Karl Rove, it's kind of amazing. Then there are all these conspiracies like that he ran crack in South Central LA in the 80s for the Reagan administration and that he weaponized the AIDS virus in the Congo.
Oh, I hadn't heard that one.
Yeah, also, and he was a busy guy apparently in the 80s. So now it's like Karl Rove, though, is heading off to that, you know, dusty Texas plain. And what are, you know, folks on the left who've hated him so much, what are they going to do with themselves? Well, we thought we'd find one. We've got Bill Scheer with us. He's a blogger at the Campaign for America's Future and at Liberal Oasis. And he's the author of Wait, Don't Move to Canada. Hi, Bill.
Hi there. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you. What was your reaction this morning when you saw the news? Did you just start crying tears of joy on the spot?
You know, it really is much more than Rove at this point. To the amount that there is, you know, personal animosity towards him and his influence on politics, I think there's a greater understanding now. This is not about any one individual. There has been a problem with conservatism over the past 6-7 years that needs to be challenged. And if we think that's going to be solved by getting rid of one staffer here, one staffer there, even if you got rid of the president, if you don't replace that with a different vision for the country, it's not going to mean anything.
But wasn't there something kind of unique about Karl Rove? He was a sort of shadowy guy, and he was pretty disdainful of the press if they would challenge him. I mean, I just felt like he was a guy that people seemed to personally fixate on.
Well, I mean, for a good reason. I mean, he is the personification of what happens when you completely mix politics and policy. You know, that has been his hallmark. You might recall one of Bush's top faith-based advisors, John DiLullo. Mm-hmm. He left the administration early and said that the political arm was running everything. And not many people really listened to his warning call. And now when you see things like global warming scientists being muzzled, or intelligence analysts having their arms twisted, or U.S. attorneys being purged, that's all part of the same attitude where policy doesn't matter, facts don't matter, whatever is good for us politically is what matters, and we've seen what impact that has on the rest of the country at this point. So Rove's been behind that, but I don't think that attitude goes away with Rove going away.
I guess what I'm wondering, though, is if there's a point at which the real impact Karl Rove had sort of left off and the kind of mythical Karl Rove picked up for people on the left.
I'm sorry, say it again?
Do you think there was a kind of like there was the stuff that Karl Rove actually had control of and the schemes that he actually hatched, and then the part of him that was just kind of like myth for people on the left?
Well, the myth was I think was very problematic for us on the left, because there was a notion that he was omnipotent, that he was so ruthless and so dominating.
Right, which has now actually been proved. He's not omnipotent.
He's not omnipotent. I mean, there are so many things that have fallen apart on his watch. You know, they did not win the midterm elections. You know, he was not able to save New Orleans from Hurricane Katrina. He has not been able to save his boss's popularity from plummeting into the depths. So, you know, in many ways, there's a big psych-out game that hurt us for a while. That made liberals think that there was nothing we could do. We might as well sit on our hands because all was lost. But when we kind of dusted ourselves off after 2004 and got back in the game, we showed that we could beat Karl Rove, not in an underhanded way, but straight up on the merits.
Is there a little teeny-weeny part of you, Bill, that's going to miss the turd blossom?
You know, there really, really is. I'm going to do just fine with him hanging out in Texas, although I fear he's not really going away. This might just be a change in address, not a real change in occupation.
Yes, the suspicion about Karl Rove continues. Thank you, Bill Scheer. He's a blogger at the Campaign for America's Future and a Liberal Oasis. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
You know, most newspaper sites, most networks, magazines, they all have these regularly updated lists of the stories that people feel the need to read over and over again, or to share, email to people, or to blog about. It's all these most lists. Some are deep meditations on life. Others are not, Shall we say. So let's take a look at the most for this Monday, August 13th, 2007.
There's a story in the New York Times that's getting emailed all over the place. It's from the magazine this weekend called Can This Marriage Be Saved? Which is a kind of an understated title, and it has an underwhelming photo on the cover of the magazine this week. It's kind of a side shot of two people in couples therapy, which is what the whole story is about. This reporter spent a year with this couples group that was meeting people that were having sort of troubled marriages. The reporter, Lori Abraham, didn't seem to be that sympathetic. Here's how the piece opens. She says, quote, "You asked me for intimacy," Marie was telling her husband of 22 years, Clem, and unavoidably, the therapist and four other couples in the room, "the same way you asked if I like croutons on my salad." She spoke slowly, deliberately, each word chipping out of her mouth like an axe striking wood. And this is one of the most emailed stories on the New York Times, which one of our producers said in the meeting today, every time the New York Times does a story about relationships, it's the number one emailed story.
It's true.
Or it's at least in the top 10. Maybe they should just turn into a relationship magazine.
First of all, what's wrong with croutons? And second of all, it's at number 3 right now as I look at the Times
with
website.
A bullet.
So dry your eyes now. Let's move on to something that makes everyone a little bit happy. From the New York Times, Two People Magazine's number one most emailed story. This is how it reads. Quote, the normally brown-eyed pop star, 25, was caught leaving the set of a video shoot in Santa Monica wearing a lace see-through top and black hot pants in addition to emerald green contacts. Yes, Britney Spears with green context is the most read story at People Magazine right now.
That seems like a story that in the headline would be fairly self-explanatory.
Pretty much.
Well, you click to the link, what do you...
Why do you have to read anymore?
What more do they actually say? The BBC, always being the classy news outfit that it is, they have this number one most emailed story from their news site. It's about a 17-year-old British girl overdosing on espresso. She apparently had 7 double espressos. She was laughing and crying uncontrollably. She developed a fever. She started hyperventilating and was taken to the hospital, where doctors confirmed she had, in fact, overdosed on caffeine. Happily, she is now fine. However, she says she's warning others about the dangers of excessive coffee drinking.
I was worried this was a fake story. I emailed the author of the story. I haven't heard back from yet, but it was a real site with a real email address, so we'll just figure the chick was buzzed. And finally, let's gaze into our own dark navel. The number one top most emailed story at NPR.org. And it's a segment from the Weekend Edition, Weekend Edition Saturday. It's part of the Annoying Music series. And because this week marks the 30th anniversary of Elvis Presley's death, this weekend story featured the worst musical tributes to Elvis. Some terrible, unlistenable stuff that apparently people want to listen to. Here's a clip.
I can't believe you guys got that tape of mine.
Now, I'm deeply moved.
That's Piranha Man from Pakistan, mm-hmm. from his breakthrough album, Blowing Goats.
No, wait. What?
It's true.
That's not really the title of the album,
it is. That's the actual name of the album.
Does goats mean something I don't know?
No, I think it means exactly what you know.
That was Scott Simon and Jim Nader from Weekend Edition Saturday. Wow. Maybe that's why it's being emailed around.
We've got lots more coming up for you on the old Bryant Park Project. We've got a big story from the internet's Pearl Jam's anti-Bush comments at Lollapalooza. Lollapalooza? Is that a horse? Well, go get that Lollapalooza on the back 40. At Lollapalooza, those comments were censored by AT&T. We're going to talk about that.
And we'll take a look at the life and the contributions of Tony Wilson, the co-founder of Factory Records, passed away over the weekend from kidney cancer.
And because Allison doesn't spend enough time talking to her husband during her normal life, apparently, Allison's hubby and resident sports guy, Bill Wolf, he'll recap the weekend on the baseball diamond, the golf course, the racetrack, just about everywhere else sports was happening.
This is the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. That, of course, is the band New Order. And fans of the group, as well as fans of the Manchester music scene, are mourning the death of the man credited with helping launch the careers of Joy Division, Stone Roses, among others. 57-year-old Tony Wilson, who had been fighting kidney cancer, died of a heart attack over the weekend. He leaves behind a legacy of a pioneering record company, music venue, and TV career. Rob Sheffield from Rolling Stone magazine joins us. He's also the author of Love is a Mixtape. Hey, Rob, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
So Tony Wilson co-founded Factory Records. Tell us what was so unique about the record company's relationship with its artists.
Well, it was a very artist-friendly record label. It really it brought experimental music to a huge number of people because Factory Records really understood packaging, it really understood marketing, and it allowed these really uncommercial kind of bands to reach a wide audience.
And they also didn't force the bands to sign contracts or something. Explain that to me.
Yeah, everything was on a handshake. They just split it 50-50 between the band and the label, and they didn't have any written contracts at all.
So how did that work out for the label and for Mr. Wilson?
Well, it didn't work out so well for the label and Mr. Wilson. They ended up, the label went down the tubes, and eventually his club, La Hacienda, went down as well.
But during its heyday, what was La Hacienda like? Describe for people its importance in terms of creating this music scene.
Well, it was hugely influential for creating what became a rave culture, techno culture, acid house culture. It was a dance club where people would go to dance to rock music, and it was where DJs could experiment with rock and dance music and house music and the sort of sounds that were just starting to take over, and that became known here as the Madchester sound, and that came from the Hacienda to all over the world.
Do you think that these bands, you know, like the Stone Roses and New Order, do you think they would have just gotten signed by somebody else eventually, or was it this guy be, I mean, is it but for this guy that we even know about these bands probably?
Yeah, they would have gotten signed eventually, but they would have had a very different time trying to reach an audience with their experimental sound. And because Tony Wilson's background was in TV, he understood hype, and he understood how to take music that was really commercially unpromising and to make people care about it. So bands like Joy Division and Happy Mondays, who are just really weird experimental groups, and he would just let them make the kind of music that they wanted to make, and he would figure out a way how to sell people on it.
Well, it's sort of interesting that you say that, because it brings me very nicely into this clip from the movie 24-Hour Party People. A lot of people might know Tony Wilson from that. The movie was all about the scene. Steve Coogan played him, and this is a clip where Wilson, his character, is discussing his dedication to the marketing campaign, this promotional 12-inch for New Order, sort of a reworked version of Joy Division for people who don't know, because their lead singer OD'd. The accents are hard to understand, but the sentiment is pretty clear. Let's play it.
There's even a visual imagination of the new mock-up. A floppy disk.
Floppy disk.
It's brilliant. It's pure, it's workmanlike, it's poetic. It's expensive. I never count the cost of music. You should know that.
Talk to you about these sleeves.
Yeah, sure.
Have you costed it? Because I have.
Was he that much of a maverick that he just didn't care what it cost to do anything?
He was an outrageous character, and he knew that the image of him as an outrageous character helped the bands seem edgy and outrageous themselves.
Over at NME, some fans have been leaving all kinds of messages. One fan posted a tribute that says, "Hail to a great man. Maybe he acted like an entertainer, but he was a pure philosopher. It was him who put the big M on Manchester, and the vibe kept on going on." He was still very active even this year, even though he had this kidney cancer.
A few months ago, he was at the Coachella Festival, and I saw him there. He came on stage to introduce Happy Mondays, and he got a bigger round of applause than the band did. And he looked better than the band did. He just came on, and he had a cane, and you could tell he wasn't 100% well, but he seemed really invigorated by the crowd. He was a showman, and he loved being there.
He must have indeed. He had kidney cancer. He ultimately ended up dying of a heart attack, though, finally. Hey, Rob Sheffield from Rolling Stone, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Let's hear a little bit of another band of Wilson helped break out, the Happy Mondays, a tribute. to Tony Wilson.
Well, staying on the music tip, there was a little bit of an incident at Lollapalooza in Chicago last week. It involved Pearl Jam. During a song, lead singer Eddie Vedder, he went into a little singing rant about how bad President Bush is. Finally, a rock band has the courage to criticize the president.
Sexy Chicks, excuse me?
Yeah, exactly. Oh, wait, they all do that all the time. Anyway, Groundbreakers, Pearl Jam, are very upset about the fact that Eddie's rant was edited out from the webcast that was being broadcast of this concert by AT&T, who was running that webcast. Here's what got edited out.
George Bush, leave this world alone.
See, it's a Pink Floyd song, but he's changed the lyrics so that it's critical of the president. That's why it's awesome. Anyway, Pearl Jam, people on the internet are very riled up. They're calling this censorship. Andy Langer is a music critic for Esquire magazine. He was at Lollapalooza and actually saw this whole thing going down. Hi, Andy.
How are you?
Good, good. Thank you for coming on the show. So do we know exactly who made the call to cut this little rant or whatever it is out of the webcast?
Well, from what we can piece together, AT&T is passing the buck on a provider of theirs. They're saying it's a vendor that they use to actually push the content onto the web, and that they, you know, they send that out, you know. And in this case, they're saying that those people made the decision, that it was not some, you know, giant AT&T VP or president or whoever who said, you know, we don't want this kind of political speech. They said it was whoever they vended it out to. They're not actually saying who that company is. But at some point, the way it works is the Blue Room cuts a deal with the festival itself. The festival
and
puts
the
it
Blue
in
Room,
the contract.
The Blue Room is the company that is kind of running the webcast.
No, the Blue Room is AT&T's branded site where they do webcasts and footage from various festivals, and you know, throughout the year they put up music content at that Blue Room. But what the Blue Room does is cut a deal with the festival for access to their performances, and the festival puts it in the contract with the bands who are playing the festival. That can easily be crossed out of the contract. So a lot of bands don't choose to participate. Pearl Jam did choose to participate and made available this webcast through the concert and the Blue Room.
Now, I mean, if in fact, you know, AT&T or some subsidiary of theirs did, like, take this little thing out, isn't it kind of their – I mean, it's their dime. It's their product. It's like if they were on Letterman and they did something that the show didn't like, they would try to cut it out for the West Coast feed. I mean, how is this different?
Yeah, I mean, what you've got is pretty tame political speech. I mean, you hear, you know, more controversial political speech in like a sixth grade recess. I mean, this was not some grand.
Have you seen what Susie Johnson's been wearing, though? I mean, in fairness.
But I mean, you know, bottom line is, yeah, it's their stream, their site. They can take it out. Now, what they say is that they have done this kind of thing before. There's cases, you know, going back a couple of years to different festivals, Bonnaroo, ACL, the Austin City Limits Festival, and this one, Lollapalooza. They've done this before. They say that it's not their intent, but and that they're looking into it, but they do admit that they've done it in the past as well and taken out political speech. But what they really say they're looking for is excessive profanity, because it's not an age, you don't have to register your age to get to the site. So since it's not age restricted, they're saying they're really looking for excessive profanity.
So, but in the end, I mean, Eddie Vedder probably does this every concert Pearl Jam plays. You don't hear about it unless you're at the show. And now they're getting all kinds of pub for this thing that got cut out. Is this probably better for amplifying Eddie Vedder's speech in the end?
Well, I mean, I don't know that Pearl Jam necessarily needs the press. I mean, Pearl Jam's never been a band that's pandered for press. I mean, they're a band that originally refused to make music videos in the height of MTV. They're also a band that's picked its fights pretty carefully. I mean, they went after Ticketmaster way back when that was a real risky thing to do. I don't know that, you know, Pearl Jam is looking for a lot of extra attention here, but I think they're calling attention inadvertently to this Blue Room. I mean, who knew about the AT&T Blue Room? I mean, just diehard music fans. And now, you know, that's become part of our, you know, at least some way political discourse. People are, you know, talking about censorship. They're talking about net neutrality. They're talking about Pearl Jam and the Blue Room. So I think it's probably best for AT&T here, because who didn't go to the Blue Room to check this thing out or to see what they're saying?
Yeah. Andy Langer, a music critic for Esquire magazine, filling us in on the Pearl Jam brouhaha. Thanks a lot.
You got it.
What's up? If it was up to me, I would have censored the entire singing portion of that concert, but that's just a little comment on Pearl. I see I waited till Andy Langer was gone because he likes Pearl Jam, and I thought he would yell at me. We're going to be talking sports next. First, though, here are some of the headlines that we are following today. Karl Rove gave an emotional goodbye at the White House news conference today. Came just hours after the news broke in the Wall Street Journal that he will leave the White House at the end of the month. He's been an aide, political advisor, and close friend of the president for 14 or so years.
And there could be trouble on the space shuttle Endeavour. NASA is deciding if it is going to send the astronauts on a spacewalk to fix a gouge in the shuttle's underside. A chunk of the insulating foam, we keep hearing about that, from the shuttle's fuel tank hit the orbiter as liftoff last week. A team of astronauts spent yesterday working on a robotic arm to get scanning equipment up close to those damaged tiles.
Two women were freed by the Taliban today. They were among the 23 South Koreans kidnapped by the Taliban back in mid-July. In July, two male hostages were executed by gunfire. 14 women and 5 men are still being held. The Taliban is demanding the release of 21 militant prisoners being held in jails by the Afghan government and U.S. military at the base in Bagram.
And Mitt Romney's campaign released his financial information today. Sit down for this one.
Fat pockets.
He is the wealthiest White House contender from either party, worth as much as $250 million.
Does he have Dennis Kucinich money, though? Oh, wait, I have Dennis Kucinich money.
And that's the news headlines at this moment. A regular feature here on the Bryant Park Project, my full admission of being a sports moron. Fortunately, I am married to a sports genius, a man with an encyclopedic knowledge culled from 13 years of working at ESPN. So let's get my Monday morning quarterback on the phone to hold my hand through the big sports news of the day.
Hello, it's Bill Wolf.
Hello, Bill Wolf. It's Allison Stewart.
Well, isn't this a pleasure as always, darling? How are you?
Good. Can I steal you from 5 minutes of work?
Oh, it's five all you want.
Easy, Tiger.
Hey,
hello, darling.
Hi, Bill.
What's doing?
Nothing. Back to hitting on your wife.
Yeah, well,
enjoy yourself.
What I do best.
Let's start with the 89th PGA Golf Championship at the Southern Hills Country Club in Tulsa. The final showdown between Woody Austin and Tiger Woods. Take a listen.
Woody Austin can tie Tiger after that three-putt, but he misses that birdie on 15, so he stays one back. Tiger, same hole, the 15th. Right after Austin got done playing it, he makes a birdie to give himself a two-shot cushion. Yeah, that means I win here on the last. He can two-putt from here to win. Does it again. Tiger Woods wins.
So Tiger Woods wins a lot, Bill. What's the big hairy deal?
Him. He's a big – first of all, I'd like to just say that golf on radio is fabulous. Secondly, the big hairy deal is him, you know. People – I think sports fans – there reaches a tipping point when you're talking about all-time greats, when everybody starts to root for the would-be all-time great to be an all-time great, because everybody likes to be witness to an all-time great. So here's Tiger Woods, who is one of the all-time greats, and if he keeps doing stuff like winning yesterday at this, you know, it's a major, one of the four major tournaments. If he keeps winning those majors, he will be inarguably the greatest of all time. And I think people just have kind of gotten on the bandwagon where they want to see history, you know? And every time he wins, it's probably part of history. That's what I think the big deal is. He's a big deal.
For a little while, there was on our 50-inch TV in our living room. There was some sort of Nextel Cup race going on at Watkins Glen. What was the headline out of that?
There were two headlines out of that. One is that this fellow Tony Stewart, who's an excellent, excellent racer, has now won three of the last four NASCAR races, and that's an unlikely achievement. They just don't win three out of four, and so he's really doing very, very well as the NASCAR version of the playoffs. They didn't used to have the playoffs, but now they do, and he's really hot. So if you're looking for who's going to be the winner of the whole thing, Tony Stewart looks like a pretty good bet. The other headline, I think, is you've heard of Dale Earnhardt Jr., haven't you?
I actually have, which
yeah,
means
right,
he's a big
he's
deal.
Yeah, on every commercial, right? He advertises for Budweiser and Wrangler and various other things. And the rub is, and he became a free agent about a month ago, and it was a big deal. Oh, my God, he's leaving his team, and they're going to pay him a lot of money to go to another team, and they did, and it was a big deal. But Dale Earnhardt finished, I think, 42nd or 41st out of 43 racers at Watkins Glen, and he is dropping further and further from the playoffs. So to me, the other headline besides Tony Stewart to the good was Dale Earnhardt Jr., the most famous of them all, to the bad. He's just not having a very good year, and there's some question about whether or not his popularity outstrips his actual ability. So I would say those are the two big headlines. Tony Stewart, excellent. Dale Earnhardt,
not so excellent.
Curiously, not so excellent.
Okay, so Saturday afternoon, look, Bill and I went to a 2-year-old's birthday party, Jake Panaccio, and we were talking to his grandfather, Arthur Panaccio from Revere, Mass. And Arthur and Bill started talking sports, and Arthur talked about the Red Sox and then put his hands around his throat, making a choking motion.
Yes.
Are the Red Sox choking?
They're doing some version of choking. They're choking a little bit. Like, let's say on the choking scale, where 0% is you win every big game and 100% is you can never win the big game, they're pulling about a 53. But the problem is, while they're pulling a 53 on the choke scale, the dreaded New York Yankees are playing like world beaters. They never lose. They've won like 25 of their last 32 games, which is astoundingly excellent. And so a race which was considered over a month and a half ago, where the Red Sox were just dominating the Yankees, is now not only is it not over, but all the momentum is with the Yankees, and the Red Sox seem to be gagging slightly. There was a game last week in which they blew a 4-run lead late in the game.
That's a lot.
Never, never choke.
Yeah, they dropped 2 games against Baltimore that they were leading down the stretch, which they have not done hardly at all this season.
Well, and as you know, Luke, the Red Sox' great strength is in their relief pitching. Mm-hmm. So they're really loaded with great people who are supposed to close games. And where they are supposed to be strong, they were noticeably weak this week. So yeah, down come the Red Sox. It just proves winning the World Series once does not change a century's legacy of chokitude, which is what's going on right now.
All right, we're having a mad debate about whether we're going to talk about your favorite story and Luke's favorite story. My real-life husband and my work husband both want to do this story.
Yeah, exactly. When your husbands agree on something, we got to go with it.
Or reject it entirely.
Yeah.
Kill two birds with one
Let's
stone.
Go with go for it. This great story about Rick Ankiel. He was this guy who was a phenom pitcher, then just lost his S. I mean, he threw 5 wild pitches in 1 game.
Well, and he did it, Luke, on the most public stage. He did it in the National League Championship Series against the New York team. So, I mean, most of us lose our S, as you say, in the privacy of our own homes or, in our cars during road rage or something. This guy lost it in front of about 15 million people.
Yeah, so then he disappears into the kind of, the dark recesses of baseball. Wasn't that the guy who lost his mind and couldn't
pitch? Yeah, he was a metaphor for losing your stuff.
And then here he comes back. He reinvents himself as a power-hitting outfielder. He gets the call back up to the Cards. And in the last week, he's been having I saw one headline that said, Roy Hobbs lives. That's the guy from The Natural, the Robert Redford character. What has he been doing the last week?
The day he got called up, first of all, he got called up because a guy on the Cardinals called Scott Spezio went into some kind of drug rehab, not known which kind. So they call Rick Ankiel up at the last second. And he's got to get this for St. Louis from Portland, Oregon, where he's in the minor leagues. And he takes 3 different airplanes, and it takes him a really long time, and he barely makes it to the park on time. And they throw him into the starting lineup, and he gets this rousing, spine-tingling standing ovation just for appearing. And then he hits the 3-run home run to win the game. And then that was Thursday night. And then on Saturday, he hit 2 more home runs. So it is a genuinely excellent story in a summer where sports has been dominated by the question of Barry Bonds and steroids, by the crooked NBA ref, by this Tour de France is all screwed up, by
Michael Vick
fighting dogs, all these negative stories that just take away all the reason we love sports. Here's a story, Ankiel, which is even people who don't like the Cardinals, and I don't
You're not
like
one
those
of them.
People, I don't like to deal with those people, but even they, this, this is a transcendently excellent story about a guy who persevered. Totally great story.
Yeah, and almost seriously, almost made me choke up a little bit. And I'm not even a Cards fan, but it's that kind of thing.
Well,
if you're a baseball
fan. As a Cards fan, I can tell you that not only did I choke up when he did it, but then when watching the highlights, I choked up, and then in seeing the post-game press conference, I choked up once again. So I got three cries on one swing of the bat.
Oh, and don't forget when you go on birdsonthebat.com blog. Yeah. I know about that. Yeah. I just want you to know. I know about that and some other things.
You need to erase the history on your web browser, Broham.
Yeah, well,
let me just tip you off on that.
Yeah.
Mr. Bill Wolf, formerly of ESPN, now of MSNBC, and of Our Apartment.
Yes.
I'll see you later on tonight, hon.
Okay, babe. See you later.
Bye, Billy.
Bye.
Well, that's been the Bryant Park Project, another rousing episode. Let's say thanks to Dan Pashman and MJ Davis and Lauren Lospo Sporer and Manoli Weatherall. Wynn Rosenfeld, Matt Martinez is the newscaster, and Luke Burbank as the Beaver.
I'm Allison Stewart. This is a little bit of Tony Wilson to take you out. I'm glad he did what he did, Luke.